27 minutes after the hour, it is a Transcendent Tuesday, and we welcome Dr. Don Clark into the conversation. Don is a biochemist, a member of the board at Creation Moments, a resident of Garden Valley, Texas, which probably most of you don't even know where that is. But if you know where Tyler is, he's just a hoot and a holler north of Tyler and by Lindale, Texas. Could you be called a wine dresser?
A vine dresser, you mean?
A vine dresser. I'm sorry. Wine dresser would be something else entirely, I think.
Someone who cares for the vines and, you know.
Well, Isaiah talked about vine dressers, so I just thought I'd pass that along to you. You know, it's an honor.
Yes,
an honorable title.
Actually, we're going to talk about Isaiah a little bit today.
Well, today
you thought we were in Daniel.
Well, you're full of surprises, Don. We've had four successive programs on the Book of Daniel, so we're calling this part five. And I haven't heard the title or haven't mentioned the titles to Don yet, but part one is entitled The Captives, part two, The Dream, part three, The Flames, part four, The Wolf. Part five, I haven't named yet because we're doing that today. We'll decide. But there's lots going on. It's a fascinating book. There's so much more information. And you mentioned something here, Webb, just kind of warming up with Don offline via a chat. And you mentioned that in chapter five, Belshazzar is all of a sudden the king. I assumed that would be Nebuchadnezzar's son, because when we left Nebuchadnezzar, he was suffering from lycanthropy, thinking he was an animal, behaving like an animal, living with the animals in the fields, and that was for like a 7-year period. Somebody must have taken over the kingdom for him at that time. I assumed it was his son. But now you tell me Belshazzar is his grandson. How does this come to be?
Well, you have to actually look at history and not, it's not in the Bible, but we know that, for example, that King Nebuchadnezzar had three sons and he had one daughter. And let's back up a little bit. So yes, King Nebuchadnezzar had the mind of a beast, as was prophesied a year earlier for him. And God basically said, hey, look, the kingdom I have given you, I am the one who raises you up. And so don't get puffed up. Well, he apparently forgets the dream that was so disturbing to him, and that Daniel, of course, had to come and save the day and interpret the dream. And he forgets about the dream, and he's on top of his palace looking over his kingdom, and he says, look how great this kingdom is that I have built. Just the very thing that God warned him about. And so God causes confusion. He becomes, he has the mind of a beast.
We would say he became insane.
He became, basically insane. I mean, he ate grass, as was prophesied. He would eat grass for 7 years, and dew would be dripping from his hair, his long hair, obviously.
Meaning he lived outside.
Grooming himself during this 7-year period. And but after the 7-year period, now the vision was a tree, and the tree was cut down by the watcher, but there was a stump. And the implication there was that he was going to come back and rule his kingdom again. We don't know exactly who was ruling the kingdom, but Daniel was, the king was very fond of Daniel, obviously. And so Daniel could have been left in charge.
It was not unlike Joseph in Egypt, because Daniel and his friends had been promoted to some sort of level of ruling class. And so it could have been Daniel that stepped in for Nebuchadnezzar during his time of insanity.
Right.
But we don't know what happened exactly when he came back. And so you're saying we need to find where do you find this history? Is there a particular book or an author or a...
Well, probably from a lot of places. I got it from a commentary. So somebody else did the research. I didn't necessarily have to dig and find it, but I guess it's Babylonian history that you can find some of this extra biblical material from. Be that as it may, Nebuchadnezzar, after 7 years, realizes that, there is a God in heaven, and it's the God of Daniel and the boys, and I'm going to praise him. And so actually, chapter 4, which was written by King Nebuchadnezzar, the start of chapter 4 is Nebuchadnezzar praising God and sending out a letter, basically chapter 4, to his kingdom saying, The God of Daniel and the Hebrew God is actually God.
But he did not make a personal commitment.
Not that we know of, but he's praising God so much, it makes you think that maybe he has made a personal commitment there at the end. Now, the point being that when he gets his right mind back after the seven-year period, he only lives a year. And then the kingdom is turned over to one of his sons, and we're going to talk about that in a moment. One other point to be made, it is interesting that it's 7 years, and it is interesting that he basically loses his mind. Now, if we go way in the future, and we have this seven-year period we call the tribulation period, it's as if the people of the earth have lost their mind.
I never made that connection. I knew 7 years, that time period is very significant throughout the Bible. But I've never connected it to the tribulation. My goodness.
So did God do this on purpose as a, you know, because King Nebuchadnezzar was ruler of the world and of the known world at that time. And so this could be sort of like a foretelling of events yet to take place when the old earth winds up losing their mind and basically having this the first beast or the Antichrist come to power.
Just a good reminder that God gives us subtle clues all the way through the Old Testament as to what's coming yet, including we talked about the statue and the iron and the clay mixed, which you mentioned and we agreed could well represent the current times. That is, we've gone through the Babylonian Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, the Roman Empire, and now we're in the modern day, iron and clay mixed. That is a group, a kingdom that won't hold together.
Yep. So we're rapidly approaching that time, I believe. But let's talk about Nebuchadnezzar and his successors. So Nebuchadnezzar has, like I said, three sons and one daughter. The daughter marries, and so the first in line is Amel Marduk, and he's spoken of in 2 Kings 25. He rules for 2 years from 562 to 559, and he's referred to in 2 Kings as evil Merodach. So he's the same guy, and so he probably wasn't a very pleasant king. And, you know, by this time, Nebuchadnezzar was probably loved by his people and probably for the most part treated them well after all of these years and experiencing the things that he experienced in his relationship with Daniel. So we have this evil king that rules for 2 years, and then his son-in-law takes over, and that is Nergal-Sarnesar, and he rules from basically 559 to 555 BC, of course. He's kind of mentioned in Jeremiah 39. So he's the king in Babylon at the time of Jeremiah 39. And he's referred to as Nergal Sharazir. So these names kind of change a little bit, but he's the same guy, if you will. After that, we have another one of his sons, Labashi Merduk, and he only reigns for 9 months in the year 555 BC. And next in line was Nabonidus. And he reigns from 553 to 536. Now, Nabonidus doesn't like ruling in Babylon, so he takes off and goes to the to North Arabia with his army.
I've heard about that one. Where did I hear, is that biblical as well?
I don't think it's mentioned
because
I
must have read that elsewhere. But that's an interesting factoid in Babylonian history. The end of the empire though is near, right?
It is very near at this point. He leaves. Matter of fact, people don't like him in Babylon. His wise men, you know, the soothsayers, if you will, don't like him, and so they say good riddance. He leaves his son, Belshazzar, in charge. So that's where Belshazzar comes in, and he says, okay, you're the co-regent. I'm going to go to North Arabia, get out of this country, and, you know, good luck, son, with the kingdom.
Yeah.
Well, that then brings us to chapter 5. Now we're up to date, and we've kind of filled in some of the missing pieces here. Like some sons of wealthy families, it's like Belshazzar is a playboy, right? So we kind of jump into chapter 5, and Belshazzar is throwing a big party, and he brings out the wine, and he's got all of his leaders of the country in. He's throwing a big party in the palace, and everything is just merry. Yeah,
the book reads, thousands of his lords were present for that. It was a party.
Yes.
A feast.
Yes. Thousands were indeed there. And but by the fact that his father, Nabonidus, had left, that kind of opened the door for Cyrus to say, maybe it's time to take this region over. So here we have Belshazzar.
Everybody listening, he was not that Cyrus was the head of the Persian Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire. And he does appear, he is mentioned in the Bible, and he made quite a difference in the world at the time.
He did, and we'll mention where he's mentioned. And so later on, Belshazzar throws this big party. Everybody's getting drunk. He's getting drunk. And he says, well, let's bring out the gold and the silver cups from the storehouse, the museum storehouse. Now, you might remember that King Nebuchadnezzar, when he took the treasures from the temple. So these are religious relics, basically, from the Jerusalem temple that King Nebuchadnezzar took and put them in his museum, basically, not necessarily to be used to defile, the religion of the Jews, but
this party is shaping up to be a slap in the face to the Jews.
It very much is. And so he calls out the gold and the silver cups, and they bring out the gold and silver cups, and they fill them with wine, and they're partying some more. And then after he does that, there is this hand that appears out of nowhere and starts writing on the wall. And King Belshazzar is you know, it describes his knees start knocking. Well, you know, he's not only afraid, he's seriously afraid. Mm-hmm. He's saying, what in the world is going on? Now, he's drunk as well.
Yeah, seriously inebriated too. So,
and he's seeing this and he can't believe his eyes, right? And so he, like Nebuchadnezzar, calls the wise men and the Chaldeans and the soothsayers, if you will, calls them in and says, what does, you know, anybody who can read this and interpret it for me, he will, he'll be third in the kingdom, and I'll give him a purple robe, meaning royalty, and I'll put a gold chain around his neck. And, you know, these guys come in, and of course they fail again. They can't read this. It's written in a cryptic form, and they can't read it. And so the queen, who is Nebuchadnezzar's wife, so she's hung around a bit. This is grandma. She comes in, and she says, you know, there is one in the kingdom that knows the holy gods, and you should call him. You should call Daniel, and he'll be able to interpret this and read this for you. And so he calls for Daniel. Daniel comes in, and of course, he's able to read it. And so he comes in, and he recounts what happened to his grandfather and why it happened to him. He recounts the story of chapter four with his granddad losing his mind, basically, and eating grass and dew drip from his hair for 7 years. And the reason why that took place was because pride was found in his grandfather. And, you know, it's only God, the real God, who raises up kings and takes them down. And so after he reminds King Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, Belshazzar, about this, he then, you know, interprets the saying, and it is the interpretation of the matter. This is verse 26 in Daniel chapter 5. It says, the interpretation of the matter is Mene, Mene, Tekel, Perez, or Upharsin. I mean, some translation has Upharsin, some translations, as the English Standard Version, has Perez. And so Belshazzar is wondering, okay, that doesn't mean anything to me. What does it mean? Well, he interprets it as saying, Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. So it's repeated. So it's very soon.
Wait a second. This is really strange. Let me read. First of all, I want to mention that the king's color changed at least twice as he witnessed the.
Yes.
I mean, that says fear or rage or whichever. But now I'm confused. Then this is verse 24 of chapter 5. Then from his presence the hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed. And this is the writing that was inscribed: Mene, Mene, Tekel, and Parsin. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Are these three gods, three kings, three people? Who are Mene and Tekel and Perez?
Oh, no, they're words, and
but they're not
Daniel
people.
Is interpreting the words.
Okay, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I mean, that's this is the interpretation. Well, he's reading them. First of all, it's encrypted. It's mm-hmm. in a code.
Okay.
And so nobody could read the words that were there, and so Daniel is interpreting it, and then this is the interpretation. So he's telling the king that, hey, you know what? Your days are numbered. You're found wanting.
And he mentions the Medes and the Persians who were about to enter the city of Babylon without doing battle. A quiet victory over the Babylonian Empire.
Yes, indeed. And how did that take place? Well, Cyrus, or Darius, as he's called in this chapter, they divert the Euphrates. So the water coming into the city was, of course, gated off, but the water was allowed, you know, to come in, but men couldn't come because the water was too high. And so the general basically diverts the water of the Euphrates around the city so that the water level lowers. And it says up to basically his the midsection of a man, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the whole army comes into town, and the rest of the people are in the palace partying, right?
Now, you've just described is historical, but not in the Bible, right? Or is it elsewhere in the Bible? Maybe perhaps Kings or...
Is it? Yes, it's. I mean, not. Okay. Yes, yes. It's historical. Yes, it's under the conquest of Babylon.
I don't want to skip verse 30 either. That very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, so he was from a different people group. The grandson was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom. So. That very night, at the end of the party, that's how it ended.
And that was the end of the party.
And there was Cyrus, yeah.
And, so Cyrus, Cyrus kind of takes over. But Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel Daniel interprets... Daniel said, I don't need anything. I don't need your purple robe, your chain, anything. I'm satisfied just serving God, basically. But Belshazzar says, okay, here, take the purple gown and the gold chain, put it around his neck, and a proclamation was made that he should be the third in the kingdom. That was the very night the Chaldean king was killed, as you just read, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. All right, so that ends chapter 5. But we're not done yet, because who is Darius? Who is this king, this Medo-Persian king that was so clever to be able to beat the great Babylonian empire? Well, the true king of the empire was away. He didn't really want the kingdom. The kingdom was weak. The son was in charge. He was throwing a big party. And all of this, of course, was God raises up and God takes down. So God is completely in control. Cyrus, he's referred to as Cyrus the Great. He's more than a great man who founded an empire from the Aegean Sea to the Indus River. He's seen as the epitome of a great leader. He's brave, he's daring, he's tolerant, he's magnanimous. These are some of the characters that have been ascribed to him. And even in Iran, they celebrated his 2,500th anniversary of his monarchy.
He's still famous. I want to point out one other thing, which to me is logical, not necessarily, it doesn't tell us this, but this party that Belshazzar threw with thousands of his lords had to have been going on during the time they were besieged or under attack by the Medo-Persian Empire, because the river didn't change course overnight.
Not at all.
In Babylon, they would have known they were about to fall. And this must have been like a wake for the kingdom, in a sense. All these lords getting together and all the wine and all the celebration, they knew it was over.
I don't know if the ones in the party knew that it was over. They certainly, the ones outside who weren't in the party, the common person, obviously saw the enemy come in.
But this would have been days
Cyrus
or weeks
and his
before.
Army didn't kill any of them.
There must have been one person. Had to be a confrontation in the days or weeks before for them to actually divert the river. So I'm thinking this was almost like a death wish party. And that's my assumption. It's just logical to me. That's all.
Yeah, and I don't know how long this party, you know, went on. It obviously probably was more than a day. But everybody who was anybody was in the party. And so nobody was really watching the gates, if you will.
I think they had effectively surrendered the city at that point. It's just that Cyrus had not actively taken control.
Well, he did take control, and
at the end of the party,
obviously, mm-hmm. and he conquered the great Babylonian kingdom, and so now the kingdom is in the hands of Cyrus, and let me see.
We're in chapter 6 now, Daniel.
Yes, so if you go to the book of Josephus, you will find that when Cyrus made his grand entry into the city, Daniel presented him with an ancient scroll of Isaiah, which contained a personal letter addressing his name, addressing him by name.
Hmm.
So, Josephus references this.
Josephus was a Jewish historian who had sided with the Romans. This was 500 years later. Yeah,
right. But Isaiah, who died 150 years before Cyrus was even born,
mm-hmm.
Wrote this obviously under the inspiration of God, and this is what it says. This can be found in Isaiah chapter 44, starting with verse 27. Who says to the deep, "Be dry, I will dry up your rivers," and who says of Cyrus, "He is my shepherd, and he shall fulfill all my purpose," saying of Jerusalem, "She shall be built, and of the temple your foundation shall be laid." In Isaiah 45:1, thus says the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have grasped, to subdue nations before him and to loose the belts of kings and to open doors before him that gates may not be closed. I will go before you and level the exalted places. I will break into pieces the doors of bronze and cut through the bars of iron. Now, and it goes on. It goes on. And you can read that in Isaiah 40, 45.
This is amazing, because that suggests that Cyrus, who did offer protection for the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem, was being obedient to God. He had seen this from Isaiah.
Daniel showed him.
Yeah.
Daniel gave him the scroll of Isaiah and showed him that, look, you know, here's your name. You are supposed to do this for Israel. I mean, it's amazing.
It is. It's amazing. It really is. And that's about all we have time for. But there's more in Daniel, a whole lot more. And
I don't think we're going to cover all of Daniel, but we'll cover some of the gems here.
Well, I'd hate to leave anything out at this point. One surprise after another coming out of the book of Daniel. Don Clark, a member of the board of Creation Moments, I want to mention their website to you. It's creationmoments.com. And they specialize in scientific information that supports and explains and teaches the biblical story of creation. And I think you'll find it a marvelous website, creationmoments.com. There's a new website in the offing that's under preparation, but the old one's pretty nice as it is. You might want to pay them a visit. Again, creationmoments.com. Don, we're grateful to you. Thank you for what you brought today. We'll look forward to part six next week, huh?
All righty. Yes, indeed.
I think we're going to wear you out. Keep up the good work.
No, this is fun. This is, I really enjoy this.
Bye-bye.
So long.